Saturday, 2nd August 1980. We'll have a shorter than usual meeting today. We all know that the living of the religious life is directed towards the release of the individual into full-fledged humanity, which, religiously speaking, means that one's awareness of existence is so transformed that one is continually, at least as a background, in communion with transcendence itself, that is, in communion with the totality, that is. Now, transcendence has been given, we use the word transcendence here in our own day and age, but it has been given many names throughout the ages. God is, of course, the simplest word used. The Upanishads used Brahman and Atma. The Buddha talked of transcendence as the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, and so on. And the other religions have just their particular name for the Supreme Being as such. Now, I think it will be useful to consider today something which occurs in one of the not so well-known major Upanishads, called the Mundaka Upanishad, Mundaka. And the statement is made about the Atma, transcendence itself. That subtle Atma is to be known by thought, wherein the senses fivefoldly have entered. And it goes on to say, the whole of men's thinking is interwoven with the senses. When that is purified, the Atma shines forth. We see here at once the fundamental topic, the purification of the whole mind. They use the word mind continuously, just as Buddhism uses the word mind continuously. You know that I prefer to use the word psyche with reference to the individual than the word mind, because mind really represents this archetypal energy on the cosmic scale, because of which the cosmos comes into existence, a cosmos of order. Not anything which is still in a state of disorder or likely to produce a disorder. The cosmic order emerges through that activity of the primordial creative energy which brings order into the scheme of things. And as a matter of fact, releases space, time and matter simultaneously into existence. Existence a standing out of the original state. Very good. And that the very first sentence is that subtle Atma is to be known by thought. Thought is the word that Hume uses in translation. Hume was a very, very great scholar and a very painstaking scholar too. And his translation was the result of his stay in India for several years, during which he was in contact with various Brahmins and the best scholars in India, so that one has to respect his translation, but within limits. The original Sanskrit word which he translated as thought is chetas. Now, chetas also means consciousness, intellect, the senses, the mind, will. It has a lot of meanings. And my own feeling is that if we translate the word consciousness, translate the word chetas by a state of consciousness, we'd be nearer the mark in understanding the whole purport and significance of this statement in the Mundaka Upanishad. Is to be known by chetas. We can use the word mind, if you like, using mind in the universal sense. Mind as that universal cosmic energy also. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is the one of the oldest and the longest of the Upanishads, it is distinctly stated, by the mind is it to be known. By the mind, not by thought. But supposing we take the word thought and take it and try and understand the two outstanding ways in which we can interpret the word thought. We have the transcendent aspect of thought. As the Trismegistic teachings put it, the thought in the mind of God. And they refer to God as All Father Mind. Now the thought in the mind of God is the real meaning, original meaning of Logos. That thought is expressed as a sound, and that sound, the vibration, is the original word, the verbum, by which the universe comes into being. So that thought, which is the creative agency, is identical with All Father Mind, the Creator itself, is identical with that. And it is obviously this creative energy, because what can we understand about the mind of God except in terms which are utterly outside our ordinary scope? Contrast that idea of thought with our thinking and what we call thought. Now this is important, because here what the Mundaka Upanishad says comes in. By chetas, wherein the senses fivefoldly have entered. Now of course we know the five senses of sight, hearing, touch, taste, smell. I'm a little surprised that they have talked of fivefoldly, because right from the beginning, discursive thinking, ordinary logical discursive thinking, was always regarded as a sense activity. And thought, in that sense, they called matter. So that the sixth sense was this sense by means of which we carried on any discursive thinking process as such. However, we'll leave it at fivefold. Now, these senses have entered the mind, as they put it. We know how our organism, the psychophysical organism, receives impressions of the outer world and also whatever emerges from within ourselves through the sense avenues. That we know. And the task of the brain is to synthesize these impressions and make a meaningful pattern, something which we call sensible as such. Now, we must remember that lovely story about the 10 blind men and the elephant. In our meetings a few months ago, I think 2 months ago, we just looked into that. And what do we learn from that story? If, for instance, just 4 senses are functioning, the brain gives a particular interpretation of that which it is interpreting. In the case of that story, the elephant. Because the sense of sight was not operating in the 10 people, they all said things which we would naturally laugh at the moment. They were all wrong, hopelessly wrong. The addition of the 5th sense made a very great difference to the result when we are expressing what was perceived was concerned. And this shows us that the perception which comes into being through sense activity is not true perception. Supposing a sixth, seventh, eighth sense were grown by nature in creatures, say in human beings. Everything would undergo complete transformation for us. What would we say with respect to all objects and all persons, all events, and all ideas and so on, abstract ideas, if we had a 6th and a 7th sense? They would be all quite different. And we would say that our perceptions, as we call them, with the use of 5 senses, were hopelessly untrue. Now, this is the important point. Our perceiving is really no perceiving. But since we are what we are, we have no option in the matter but to call our no perceptions perceptions. But if we bear in mind that there are no perceptions really, then we will be wary with regard to what we call truth, ultimate reality. It remains at the level of the indescribable. It's unthinkable, unimaginable, and so on. And this is of very considerable importance, because it affects our conduct in life. According to our perceptions, we try to live what we call good lives in accordance with our perceptions of what is good. And we try to avoid what is evil. But since our perceptions are not true perceptions, we must be awake to the fact that what we call good is not the fundamental or absolute good. And therefore, if we are warned, if we remain in that state of being warned within ourselves, we can avoid so many mistakes, a great many mistakes. And more important still, by the avoidance of the mistakes, we would keep quiet. People rush into action, thinking that this is the right thing to do, according to their perceptions, which they believe are true perceptions. But once we see that our perceptions are not true perceptions in the real sense of the word, therefore it is wise to hold one's horses and keep quiet. And so the value of silence, the value of quietness, comes in upon us. And of course, to our benefit in every way. So now, the senses are not reliable. And then there is the other aspect. The brain itself is able to see that any proposition, as well as to any proposition, as well as to its opposite, we have to give the dual answer, yes and no. And this, of course, makes things extremely difficult. So we see that that the ultimate truth, as far as we are concerned, because of our constitution, because of the way the psychophysical organism functions, is not statable. One may use a word, God, creative power, Brahman, anything you like. One may use a word, but we must be well awake to the fact that that word symbolizes that which is quite beyond us. It is not the known, it is the unknown. And because of the limitations imposed upon us by our constitution, it remains the unknowable in our ordinary sense of the word knowing and knowable. This is very important. If we see this, if we really see this, then obviously we would be naturally humble. True humility would prevail. No conceit. It's extraordinary how people who are well trained, well bred, well brought up, and so forth, and try to develop humility as a virtue, in some respect or other, they are far from humble. They are quite sure about what they say, what they think, and consequently frightfully assertive. And, well, just to be assertive is unpleasant enough. But they can be frightfully cruel and do terrible deeds. Look at the inquisitors. Look at our modern inquisitors in certain parts of the world. And they are murderous activities. You see? Because they are convinced that this is the ultimate truth. And that's that. That their perceptions are true. But their perceptions are far from true. So we have to bear this in mind. And our whole thinking process, which is a talking process, which is a deductive process. We deduce this, that and the other from the sense impressions we have received and from the evidence, as we say, which we have seen and heard and which we believe in as conveying the whole truth and nothing but the truth. All that has no fundamental basis. It is void of reality. It is void of truth. And yet, man, through the ages, certainly through several millennia, at least 5,000 to 6,000 years now, has been able to enter into a state of awareness where he can have a true perception. And where he can produce a thought in the transcendent sense. Produce a thought in the transcendent sense. Now, what does that mean? All our thinking depends upon the functioning of the senses and the utilization of language, of speech, to interpret that functioning of the senses. All our thinking depends upon that, doesn't it? So, this is it's a dependent process. If any particular factor which is responsible for the dependence of our thinking upon it were out of the situation, then our thinking would change accordingly. If two or three factors were out, well, then again our thinking would change still more. If all the factors were out, all the conditioning influences of the sense activities would be out. And then what happens? If one is awake to that state of consciousness, one can produce a thought which is not dependent upon objects, things, anything external, anything internal to, which is entirely independent. Now this kind of thought, this meaning of thought, is the thought which is creative energy, creative activity. See? The thought which is entirely independent, not contingent upon anything, unrelated to the ephemeral world of things and so forth. This thought is a creative energy, is a creative energy in itself. It is infinite, it is self-replenishing. It doesn't depend upon anything at all. It exists, it is purely self-existing as such, in its own rights. Therefore it belongs to a transcendent context, the context of infinity. It has no limits, it is eternal, it is not subject to time, and it is immortal. It knows no such thing as death, nor does it know any such thing as birth. It is there, absolute, in its own rights. This thing, we can talk about again. When I'm saying these things, one can always raise objections or problems and so forth. But if we can begin to get the feel of it, we can escape, we can get free of all the limitations imposed upon our thinking process. Getting free of the limitations upon our thinking process means the purification of the psyche. You see? It means that the psyche is being purified all along the line. As the Upanishad says, when the whole of man's thinking is interwoven with the senses, when that is purified, the Atma, the transcendent, shines forth. Now this is the marvel of it, that although constitutionally we can never know in the supreme sense the transcendent, it is the unknown and the unknowable, although that may be the case, transcendence can shine forth through us because we have ceased to be obstructive organisms. Just as transcendence shines forth as the perfect flower or the perfect animal or whatever it is. Transcendence manifests itself in innumerable ways through the various kingdoms of nature. The perfect gem, that is transcendence manifesting itself in that particular form, in that particular way. Of course, the diamond doesn't know it is a diamond. It's completely unconscious of it. The diamond can have no conceit, no pride, no sense of, oh, I am a diamond of the first luster. The intrusion of the I am I consciousness is completely out. And therefore, it is perfection itself. It is perfect. Now the same thing can happen with human beings. And of course, we are a very special sort of creature, species of the animal world, we human beings. So we must see, understand how the sense activities, indispensable as they are hindrances all along. We must be careful never to feel, oh, I've got it now, this is it, and so forth. I have true perception. My thinking is true and pure thinking. It isn't. Never is, unless and until there is the complete purification of the whole situation. A purification which is effected by, of course, observation. Observe the entire situation, the entire process. In that observation, there is no I, John Brown, observing. There is no consciousness of self intruding upon the observation. There is pure observation. Like the grin on the face of the Cheshire cat. Then there was only the grin left, no cat. So there is only the observation there, no intruding I present, in consciousness, mind you. Of course, the organism is there. You can't get away from it. And then when that happens, it is through this very organism, which has become utterly free of all isolating self-consciousness, that transcendence shines forth. And that is the realization of the Atma. The Upanishads constantly use the phrase realizing the Atma in relation to the perfected Holy One. He who has realized the Atma is the perfected Holy One. And so we see the whole process which is there. And the importance of pure observation. A pure observation, total observation, means not only being intensely aware of the sense impressions which are being received, but also of being intensely aware of the reactions from the brain to those impressions as they come in. One sees a car, and immediately the brain starts talking about it, says all sorts of things. Be intensely aware of that, and intensely aware of the car, a shape and color, as far as the sense of sight is concerned. As far as our capacity to drive is concerned, other impressions come in there. And so forth. So it's the intensity of that awareness of the whole situation, the situation as a totality and not as something cut adrift from the totality, which affects the purification of the whole process. And the defilements of the mind fall off like scabs from a skin which is healing properly.